my God. It's Wednesday, March 4th. What a long night last night was. This is The Attitude with Artie Arneson and Ken Barnes. It's kind of a windy day out there. It's going to get windy in here, too, I suspect. But as you know on this radio show, we begin every day between now and the November election of 2020 with the words of Colonel Finman as he was testifying before Congress. The most poignant part is, don't worry, Dad, it'll be okay. And I'm like, no, it won't. Anyway, Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
I don't know if it's possible, but every single time I hear it, and I've been hearing it now for weeks now, it still kills me. It still just breaks my heart. It will not be okay unless we make change in November of 2020. All right, everyone. It's going to be a very interesting first half hour of the show. We have in studio Rick Newman. Rick Newman is a former state legislator. He is currently a lobbyist. He is from more of the moderate Democratic camp, so I wanted his voice. Joining us by phone is Harold Meyerson. Harold Meyerson, I think, describes himself as a socialist, so this is good. He also is the editor, executive editor of the American Prospect. He just has a new piece out about what happened last night. Of course, Ken Barnes is here, and I am here as well. So I just want to let you know that I'm gonna start, gentlemen, with my tweet from this morning. Moderate Dems just created the composite candidate, the voice of Pete, the grit of Amy, the energy of Beto, the mini-me of Obama. It worked swimmingly well for the 3 days between the South Carolina blowout delivered by Clyburn and Super Tuesday. But in the end, oh, well, it's still only Joe. Are we sure he can deliver the win in November? And on that note, let me welcome to the program, Harold, since you're the most remote one, Harold Meyerson, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always good to be here, however remotely, Arnie.
However remotely, and of course, Rick, thank you as well. I'm going to start with Harold again because he's not in the room, and then because I can eyeball everybody else. Oh, my goodness. What else can I say? It was an interesting night, but in some ways not a surprising night, as you saw what happened with Beto and Amy and Mayor Pete and, to some extent, even Barack Obama with Susan Rice sort of, you know, mirroring what Obama wanted. That was the hands-on kind of thing, that there was the word that was going out that virtually every camp other than the Bernie camp was sort of surrounding Joe Biden, and he didn't need an office, and he didn't need a message, and he didn't need money. He just needed them and the free media that he got in about 72 hours to deliver quite a remarkable, turnout yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, this is viewed without any, you know, ideological or even political lens, this is, you know, a spectacular drama. I mean, you know, as I when I was writing about this, I noted, you know, Lazarus had Jesus and Biden had Jim Clyburn, and you know, I mean, and Lazarus didn't carry Texas, and Biden did. You know, I mean, this is really an amazing, a completely amazing turn of events, which is what happens when the wing of the party consolidates that was other than the Bernie wing. Now, the interesting thing if you look at, if you go way down into the exit polls and see what people believe in every single state, I think, that voted, you know, the exit polls asked them, do you support essentially Medicare for all or keeping private insurance? And Medicare for all won in every single state. So you begin then to ask the question, okay, if voters agree with Bernie on some key issues, why did they vote for Biden? And clearly this was all about their perception that, you know, Biden had a better chance than Bernie to win in November. Now, the problem, either way, no matter which of them had emerged victorious and became the likely nominee, which I think Biden probably is you know, the divisions in the party are still very real. And one way to look at that, if you look at the exit polling by age, never mind even just voters under 30, voters under 45 still decisively, you know, outside of states that were heavily African-American, decisively preferred Bernie. Biden was getting about 16%, 17%, 18% of voters under 45 in the non-Southern states last night, and California, he got 8% of voters under 45. And Bernie mirrors this with people over 65.
Right.
And these are really almost existential differences. The younger voters have sort of experienced really a very dysfunctional economy for the last, you know, yeah, for their whole lives.
Yeah, exactly.
If either, you know, I mean, I think what a word I seldom use, what behooves both candidates is to try to figure out how they can cross this this great divide. I think Biden, you know, do we want an economic stimulus program that's progressive? Get rid of student debt. That puts $1.5 trillion
back into the economy
in the hands of people who badly need it, and that could really be a boost to you know, much of the economy. Okay. So anyway, that's sort of my
okay. All right. So let me turn to Rick. And you said something interesting that I just want to sort of as a segue to you, Rick. Before we got on the air, I said that one of the reasons why I thought there was an enormous turnout yesterday, too, that was the other thing. Mm-hmm. You saw numbers that we had not seen before historically. We also saw a lot of what we were hoping to see, or see the suburban women coming in and voting. And for the most part, they were voting for Joe Biden. And Harold mentioned something I thought was fascinating, which was that, you know, across the board in every state, Medicare for all won. And what I said to you was one of the reasons why I thought there was an enormous turnout on Tuesday was because of the coronavirus. Because, you know, while you and I may get in the weeds and see all the things that the Trump administration has done, deregulation, EPA, you know, putting in what is it, 21-year-old in charge of some major office, gutting everything, that's in the weeds. What a lot of people have seen now is his inability to respond effectively with honesty and truth and respecting the scientists and the doctors this pandemic. And I think as a result, you see people showing up in droves. I'm not even sure that they know between Bernie and Biden what this Medicare for all is. All they know is, God damn it, I got to go to a doctor when I'm sick and I don't want to have to be out of network and I don't care about it. I mean, so they're willing to do this because they're so scared. I think that the coronavirus means so many things, both economically as well as from a health perspective, as well as from a security perspective. And that's just my thought.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, nobody really likes the government until they need it.
Exactly.
I mean, that's just the way we all are.
Brilliant headline.
And
brilliant headline.
You know, this coronavirus could be Trump's Katrina.
Yes.
I mean, when we're all looking at it, we're all trying not to panic and everybody keeping their level head. But at the same time, I'd like to have confidence that the people that are in charge of making sure we're okay know what the hell they're doing.
Right.
And I don't think the American people have that confidence right
exactly.
now. And that's why, I agree with you. I think that's part of the reason why. We saw enormous voter turnout across the country yesterday. You realize Virginia doubled what they did in 2016, mm-hmm. and they exceeded what they did in 2008.
Wow.
This is when the most popular Democrat of our time was running in 2008.
Right.
And more people came out to vote yesterday than voted then. And that happened across the country. And I think if I was a Republican strategist or whatever they're calling themselves these days, working for Trump, I would be extremely nervous because you're looking at, here we come, guys. You know, we're coming. And the voters are out there. People are nervous and people want competence.
Right.
And they know they don't have it now.
And let me just say something else, because you talked about the confidence and the sense of security and knowing that this will be a challenge for whoever the leader is. And you have to admit, Harold, that what Barack Obama exuded was this sort of stable, secure, confident, articulate. I mean, he knew how to get you feeling at least calmer about the hysteria you were about to experience. And I think that to a large extent, Biden, even though I'm not sure he has that same capability, but because he was with Obama for 8 years, we immediately sort of said, well, we can return to that sense of feeling a little more sense of trust and safety and security. And it isn't even about the issues per se. It is both about electability, but it is about the fact that we want that feeling again. And that's what Donald Trump has absolutely undermined. There is no sense of stability with him. All you have a sense is that he's ready to blow everything up, including your lives, including your healthcare system, including your economy.
And I think the other main contrast between Biden and Trump is on the personal. I mean, people who aren't, you know, particularly enamored of Biden's politics on the left side of the Democratic Party acknowledge that this is, you know, a fundamentally decent guy. And no one really thinks of Trump as fundamentally or even remotely decent. I mean, Biden exudes a basic sort of
humanity,
kindness and empathy, which are utterly foreign to Trump. So, in a way, I think, you know, I mean, Obama was always a cool character and hugely charismatic. And, you know, I mean, the word presidential, I think, really defines Obama. Biden, you know, is you know, a little shakier, but he's warmer. He's certainly warmer, I think, than Obama. And I think that's worth a lot when the guy you're running against is Donald Trump, who is sort of, you know, emotionally calcified, and all of his love is focused on himself and no one else.
I love these terms, calcified. I got to write these all down. So I'm looking at Rick, and let me just say something else, because as you were talking about Joe Biden, I know Joe not as well as I know Bernie. And I've known Bernie for 35, 40 years. And let me just say something else. That is also a weakness for Bernie. Bernie does not know how to emote well either. And I've always, I mean, I know, you know, we agree a lot on the issues, but he doesn't do empathy well. He doesn't do emotion well. When I was listening to Joe Biden's speech, it was obviously well-crafted after what happened in South Carolina. He knocked it out of the park. I mean, he knocked it out of the park because it was just, it was the right kind of emotion. It was the right kind of thanks. It was the right kind of humbleness. It had all those right, he pushed every of the right buttons. So whoever wrote it not only had his voice, but made sure he didn't go off the reservation, which is what he tends to do. And I hear this also, Rick, with Mayor Pete. Mayor Pete, too, has that sort of emotional voice. And I think what we're sort of hearing with Donald Trump in an interesting way is also kind of a deficit with Bernie Sanders, is that he doesn't have that emotional connection. He knows how to sort of rah-rah the crowd, but I'm not sure he knows how to sort of calm me down. And sometimes I need that too, Rick.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a good point. I mean, you know, they're both, and I don't mean this in Bernie's case to be disparaging, but Bernie is more of a zealot. I mean, Bernie is
a cause. He is a
cause. And, you know, when you're leading a cause, you're not necessarily touching, you know, an individual.
Right.
You know, somehow successful politicians other than Trump have always found a way. Bill Clinton, you know.
Oh, my God. I feel your pain.
And, you know, I mean, Barack Obama, you know, he touched you. And George W. Bush did that as well.
Yeah.
We don't see that with Trump. And it's more difficult for Bernie to do it than Joe.
Yeah, absolutely. It can.
While you were talking, it occurred to me to make a connection. You were talking about the coronavirus. People are so scared. and they don't want to have to pay all this money out of their private insurance, medical
insurance. Or they can't afford to pay it.
They
it's
can't,
an affordability
right,
issue.
Or out of network.
Right,
I mean,
right,
my
right,
God, what if
right.
I get a fever in Dallas?
You know, exactly, exactly. Which but, doctor do I go to?
Yeah, but that's a financial thing. That would make people, I would think, gravitate towards Bernie because Medicare for All is going to solve the financial problem. But that's just financial. Yeah. And what Joe's calmness and warmth do is it kind of makes you feel like everything's going to be okay, almost like Ronald Reagan. But Joe has a special kind of warmth that emotionally tends to people who are afraid of coronavirus rather than financially. And the emotional is more powerful than the financial.
And Harold, right now, I want to raise two things. One, I think Bernie Sanders never made the immediate connection between what Medicare for All meant and their sense of concern. He still was very strident about the revolution and Medicare for All and the whole idea, but he didn't connect it to the fact that our current healthcare system has so many holes in it that people may not be able to access the kind of healthcare they need. They may not be able to get the kind of hospital care they need. So we have a system that is weak from a public health perspective. It's weak from a coverage perspective. It's weak from an affordability, even if you have damn health insurance perspective. Mm-hmm. He never really sort of threaded the needle to the immediacy of people's concerns at this moment. In addition to which, Harold, did you saw what the governor of New York did? Andrew Cuomo basically said that he was ordering all health insurance companies not to charge people for things that were related to COVID-19. So in an interesting way, creating a little tiny mini Medicare for All for COVID-19. I mean, and if I were Bernie, if I had seen that, I would have had 12 commercials on going, so if it's good for COVID-19, how come it ain't good for my cancer? How come it's not good for my diabetes,
Yeah, but if I were Biden, and I think he's the more likely to be the nominee, I would say what Andrew Cuomo said because I think that would, among other things, that would help Biden with some of the people who weren't in his camp last night, yesterday. I think the whole coronavirus thing presents a political opportunity to make the case for more accessible and more affordable health care, and I think Biden should double down on that, as well as Bernie doing exactly what you said, Arnie.
Yeah. So Rick, how do we bridge the divide? And we have to. I mean, I feel like I live in the divide because, I am definitely a progressive. I'm definitely a lefty. I understand the issues. I've been arguing them for 35 years. I also understand the other camp, okay, because I've lived in New Hampshire. And New Hampshire has Jean Shaheen. It has Maggie Hassan. It has, all the people that we have elected, not Arnie, but everyone we've elected who's been a Democrat, and all those Democrats got elected after Arnie, just to remind you, I needed to sort of break the logjam, and then they got – and you know how Jean Shaheen ran for governor? This is absolutely true. Jean Shaheen, when she ran for governor in 1996, this is absolutely true, Harold, she's running against an uber-conservative named Ovid LaMontagne, anti-choice, very conservative, yada, yada.
I remember him.
You remember him? And this is how Jeannie ran, and I didn't know it because reporters told me after the fact. She would – and I'm running for Congress at the same time she's running for governor. This is how she ran for governor. I'm not Ovid and I'm not Arnie.
Mm-hmm.
All right? I want everyone to hear this. Mm-hmm. I am running next to her as a congressional candidate for, to go as a state as a representative, but I had run for governor on a very progressive platform. Got more votes, by the way, than any Democrat in history in 1992. But when she ran for governor, she made sure everyone knew I am not Ovid and I am not Arnie. So I know there's an interesting place, Rick, for what is success for elections. My question is, how does that translate into success for working people, into affordability, into college debt, into the environment? We know it's successful for people who, live on, Wall Street. I just want to know how winning with them fixes things for me.
Well, to your point you started with, how do we bridge the divide? That is going to be incredibly difficult.
Yes.
Because Bernie has shown up to a very large number of people, about a third of the Democratic voters. I'm going to give you this. These are the things we're going to do together. And if he's not the nominee, they're going to be incredibly disappointed. And they're going to look at Biden and describe him just the way you just did.
Right.
And how many of those people will be willing to go to the polls in November? When will it? I guess the question is not when, but will it? Will it become to them that it's more important to get rid of this guy that we've got in the White House today than anything else? And to me, it is. To me, that's the underlying question. We've got to put the revolution on hold to put the fire out that this guy starts every morning that he gets up.
That's a really good point that he made. So Harold, give me the GPS. I'm looking on my maps and I'm trying to figure out how it happens. And you and I both know Bernie has compromised. He's compromised his whole life.
Sure.
He compromised as mayor. He compromised in Congress. Voting for the ACA was a compromise. He voted for it. You know, but his big claim to fame are all the amendments that he passed. Not the bills that were under his hand. But you know what the amendments were? The amendments were compromises. Can he tell people what those amendments were? He's afraid to use the word with his own base because he's made the word so tainted. But you know what? He is like the walking definition of compromise because all those amendments, that's exactly what they were. So
yeah,
how do you write at the American Prospect a roadmap so we can figure out how to bring folks together because Donald Trump is the existential threat?
Well, I'm actually going to do that in the next couple of days or try to do it. But a couple of points. Again, if you go way down in the exit polls, they ask a question, will you support the Democratic nominee, no matter who that is?
Right.
And, you know, maybe about a fifth or a sixth of respondents did not say yes.
Right.
But then if you break that down, there were a number of Bernie people who didn't say yes, but there were also a number of Biden people who didn't say yes because they didn't like the idea that the nominee might be Bernie. So this is a general problem because
yeah.
Almost the existential gulf between where Bernie's at and the sense of where Biden is at is really large. So, you know, I mean, basically, I think Biden would have to, you know, do things like move his position on student debt and things like that. And Bernie, if I were Bernie, and you know, since he's bombing with seniors, I would downplay the Medicare for All and talk about the enhancements to actual existing Medicare, like
yes.
it, you know, adding vision and dental to what it covers.
Right.
I mean, that's the beginning. But, you know, beyond that, I mean, that's sort of the words. The music is harder.
The music is harder.
You know,
good
I mean,
line.
There's kind of an emotional riff there, too. And I don't think any of us have a great solution to that, except, you know, if Biden is a nominee, you know, Bernie campaigned for a hell of a lot of Democrats over the last 4 years, not all of whom he agreed with, and you know, including, you know, in the general election of 2016, when she was the nominee, Hillary Clinton. You get the sense that Bernie and Biden actually, at some level, kind of like each other.
Yeah, there's not the same animosity between.
Yeah. Right.
I mean,
right.
Let's also remember, and I want people to sort of reflect on this. In 2016, we were asked to choose between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump was the most unliked candidate for president ever in polling history. The second most unliked candidate in polling history was Hillary Clinton.
And, the same
and that is just shocking when you realize that was what we were being asked to choose between.
And if you look at what's happening
and
now...
Biden,
hold on. Rick, Harold. Yes?
Well, if you look at what's happening now, you can really see that come to life, right? Because Bernie Sanders got 60% in New Hampshire against Hillary. He got 26% against
right.
the field. His numbers everywhere are down dramatically over...
Because it's not Hillary.
He lost Minnesota yesterday.
Right.
He won it 4 years ago because he was running against Hillary. That dislike factor was really in play in 2016.
Right, right.
I think a lot more so than many of us thought, and I don't think it's there this time.
No, it's not there this time. I know you want to say something, Ken. You have your hand.
Yeah, I was just going to say the answer to the question maybe, the Bernie voters who are disappointed that Biden just isn't going to be as good at solving their problems that they got their hopes up about, well, the answer I think that he can run on is it's a different election. yes, I, Biden, might not make things a whole lot better the way Bernie would, but Trump, if he's reelected, would make things worse for you. And at least if I'm neutral or only a moderate amount of betterness, dental and vision added to OCA, then that's way better than Trump is going to be, who's trying to get rid of OCA altogether.
Right, right, right. But I think, Harold, I want to go back to what you said, that we know what the words are. We just have to write the music. So I'm waiting for the music because I think what we need to do is take a look at what Abraham Lincoln did. He brought his enemies close. That was his style of leadership. And I think that what Biden has to do is recognize that this really needs to be a quilt. And if he can bring the right quilt together, he can show people that in the end, we want to move this nation forward. We want to heal the divide. We don't want to sort of exacerbate the divide. And I think that is going to be something I think he's aware of. I really do think he's aware that Biden is. Now the question is, can Bernie figure out what the music is to talk to his base? Because that's going to be his job.
Yeah. That's going to be the challenge. What it can say, a moderate amount of betterness is not really a great bumper sticker.
But it's better than making things worse.
But you're not showing your political skill set right there. That's what he's saying.
Elizabeth
Warren was fond of saying that personnel is policy, and Elizabeth Warren, by the way, is someone who got the policy, I think, brilliantly, and the politics has been what's the problem with her campaign. Biden really needs to, as you suggested, Arnie, reach out to particular political figures on the other side of the divide, and that could begin.
I got it. I got it, Harold.
The music a little.
All right, so Harold, I'll set the table and I'll invite them. I want AOC and I want Biden to come for lunch. I think that's how we start. And on that note, thank you, gentlemen, so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. No other show does this. I'm just telling you right now. All right, everyone. A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Artisan.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1989. That was the day machinists struck at Eastern Airlines. After bankrupting Continental Airlines to void union contracts there, the much-hated Frank Lorenzo hoped for a repeat at Eastern Airlines. Lorenzo bought Eastern with junk bonds and then bled the airline's profits dry to finance the debt of his holding company, Texas Air. 12,000 jobs were lost at Eastern in just 2 years under Lorenzo's leadership. Machinists had every reason to believe that wages would be cut in half in the next contract. In the weeks building up to the strike, management made its union busting clear by firing dozens of shop stewards at airports across the country. Machinists walked out at Miami Airport a month earlier over forced overtime. Nationwide, many complained that they were forced to work anywhere between 24 and 36 hours straight. 5 days into the strike, Lorenzo filed for bankruptcy. Picket lines were solid and the strike was popular. Many trade unionists joined the picket lines in support. The strike against Eastern symbolized a fight to take back everything lost during the Reagan years. The Airline Pilots Association and the flight attendants organized by TWU voted to walk out in solidarity. They stayed out for more than 8 months with the striking machinists. But when the pilots and flight attendants went back to work, it left the machinists isolated. Many argued that with contracts expiring at many airlines soon after the walkout, an industry-wide strike could only bolster chances for the machinists at Eastern to win. But by early 1991, the strike had become a devastating loss. Eastern ceased operations altogether in January, and its assets were liquidated.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Where the land meets the sea, you'll often find coastal wetlands called salt marshes. During high tide, salt water floods the low-lying part of the marsh, the tidal flats. The high marsh, a drier sandy area, floods less frequently. When there's a storm, the high marsh provides an important buffer, helping protect inland areas from waves and flooding. But as the climate changes, rising seas could put high marshes in jeopardy.
What we've been doing is trying to figure out how will salt marshes respond to sea level rise.
That's Martin LaFrenz, a geographer at Portland State University. He and his colleagues have been studying salt marshes along the Oregon coast. He says by 2050, the high marsh will begin to shrink.
And then by 2100, a very large decrease in the amount of high marsh and a very large extension of the tide flats.
He says roads and dikes prevent the high marsh from expanding inland.
So the marsh can't migrate anywhere. It's sort of stuck in place. And so what that means is as we lose that high marsh, all the coastal communities will be losing that protection from stormwater and from storm surges.
So he says in many cases, they need to consider moving vulnerable resources inland. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Like a Refugee. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Can you remind us who sings that song?
That is the great Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Oh, God. All right. So before I bring up my guest, let me sort of open up with a headline that I saw from the Associated Press last night. UN, world's biggest humanitarian crisis in Syria and Northwest. Here we go, United Nations. The top UN humanitarian official for Syria said Tuesday the crisis in northwest Idlib, where nearly 1 million people have fled to avoid escalating hostilities, is probably the biggest crisis we have in the world today. Kevin Kennedy said that despite a massive release operation, the needs are overwhelming, and we have a long, long, long way to go. I have been talking on and off about Syria and what's been happening, and I was like, what to do? These babies are freezing. The families are freezing. What to do? What to do? But we've been so distracted because of COVID-19, because of this election, because of Donald Trump, because of the flailing stock market, that we haven't focused on just incredible needs. So joining us right now is someone who wrote at theconversation.com. You know I adore that site. And the title of her piece was The Worst Humanitarian Crisis of the 21st Century, Five Questions on Syria Answered. Joining me right now is Shelley Inglis, the executive director, if I pronounce your name wrong, please correct me, the executive director of the University of Dayton Human Rights Center and research professor of human rights and law. If you look at her bio, you are blown away. You must be 95, but you're not because I saw your picture. She comes to the United Nations Development Program, where she held various management positions working on peace building, democratic governance, rule of law, and human rights, and the sustainable development agenda at the UN headquarters in New York. Prior to doing that, she held several other positions with the UN, the Rule of Law Unit, and the Office of the UN Deputy Secretary General, yada, yada, yada. I could go on and on and on, but I don't want to because it's too important. You give us information about Syria. You explain to us how we got here, what is winning for Assad, given the kind of death and destruction that we've seen over the last 9 years. And maybe the most important thing, Shelley, is what the hell can we do, and where is the United Kingdom and where is the U.S. when it comes to this humanitarian catastrophe? Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Arnie. Thanks for having me on your show.
It's a pleasure.
So, the worst humanitarian crisis of the 21st century, and what Kevin Kennedy was talking about, is one episode within a 9-year conflict and crisis, which as many people might not fully realize, has pushed millions of people outside of Syria. Over 6 million people have left the country. They primarily reside in Turkey, which hosts around 3.6 million refugees. In Lebanon, where Lebanon hosts per capita the largest amount of refugees of any country in the world. In Jordan. And in 2015, a migrant, what was called a migrant crisis, but primarily a refugee crisis, because the majority of those coming from Turkey into Europe were from Syria and other countries that you can identify them as refugees as opposed to migrants, were flooding into the European Union. And an agreement was made between the European Union and Turkey to have them primarily remain in Turkey. And that has opened up a new, what is called migrant, but refugee and migrant crisis for Europe. And then within Syria itself, you have massive devastation. You have 400,000 people killed. And then you now have, in this particular episode that we're talking about, sort of the crux or the height of the conflict, maybe, is 2 million people in need of assistance. Turkey having closed their border, both Turkey and Russia having explicitly entered Syria to fight in this war. The United Nations claiming that Russia now, and naming Russia explicitly as responsible for war crimes in northern Syria. And a U.S. which, as you know, in October withdrew key military presence from Syria, and then allowed a sort of vacuum to be filled. The historic support that the U.S. had for the Syrian Kurds in their fight against ISIS, in the midst of this war, ISIS became a large factor. That fell away. The Syrian Kurds were undermined. And we now have Russia controlling much of the airspace of northern Syria, supporting the Assad regime, and a terrible crisis.
Can you, I mean, in a way, I want people to have an arc of history. We're talking about this has been going on for 9 years, everyone. 9 years. How the hell did it start? What was the goal? What was the accomplishment? I sort of asked the question, if Assad wins, what has he won? Because I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, there's only losers here. And being able to vanquish, what are you defeating? So can you give me a little bit of the history of where we were 9 years ago so that I understand, or maybe I'm even more confused about where we are today?
So, yeah, I mean, there was a peaceful uprising in Syria, which was part of what was sort of a misnamed, at the end of the day, Arab Spring period in history, where a number of popular movements and social movements came to the fore in Arab countries demanding forms of democracy, demanding change in age-old regimes that were, you know, authoritarian in
corrupt.
Nature.
Corrupt.
Corrupt and authoritarian. And, right. and as the house, the family of Assad, was four decades in control in Syria. And this peaceful uprising was a demand for change. And that, you know, became a very complicated set of conflict within Syria. And Syria has historic connections to Iran and historic connections to Russia. And Russia has a veto role on the UN Security Council, as does China, as does the United States, as does the United Kingdom and France. And there were efforts, obviously, in the UN side to try and manage the crisis. There's been UN envoys around Syria for the entire period of the conflict. But unfortunately, there's been very little ability to find a space for a peace agreement. And even now, as you mentioned, it's unclear assuming there is a victory to be said or some kind of victory to be said for Assad, what exactly and how exactly Syria will be governed if this crisis comes to end is incredibly unclear. But it is representative of the fact that the international community has simply not been able to find a peaceful means for addressing this conflict. And of course, it got quite complex with rebel opposition groups and ISIS. And the use of the term terrorists and terrorism, that has also been, one of those issues that people have different views on the various rebel groups who are the opposition to Assad and to what extent they are actually reflective of the kind of peaceful democratic future that the international community presumably wants to see for Syria and its people.
So you mentioned the Arab Spring, and I want to go back to something I heard back in 2016. So during the 2016 election, one of the things I also heard was that what sort of created this situation in Syria dealt actually in part from climate change, and that what there was these significant droughts. And that the farmers that were living in the more rural areas of Syria were not able to survive. And so as a result of that, this is what I remember, and you can tell me whether this is accurate or not, that they kind of flooded into the cities that were not prepared and did not have the capacity to sort of handle this significant change in population that had obviously demands, perhaps not necessarily the kind of skills that weren't perhaps needed. And all of a sudden, so you have both this frustration with the Assad regime, which had been around for decades, that obviously were not prepared to respond. You had this sort of change, very, very sharp change in population virtually practically overnight. And that created this sort of cocktail of failure. And when you look to a large extent, in part, it is a reflection of the kinds of things we're going to be seeing going forward as a result of the climate crisis that is going to sort of unsettle so many things that we are not prepared to deal with.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think your rendition of the history bears out in a number of studies around the links between the climate crisis and the conflict in Syria. I think a lot of our conflicts have climate-related dimensions now, with a tremendous amount of stress being put on communities. That, as you said, combining with frustration around governance systems in today's world, being unable to manage, unable to deliver results for people, and a higher expectation on the part of people for certain types of results on economic and social issues, including climate. There's just been simply a sea change because of technology and global international economic systems, globalization overall, in the amount of information that individuals have and the expectations that people have and the sense of the lack of trust in institutions, the lack of trust in government and media and other institutions to be able to deliver on addressing the challenges. And so you see a wave of social movements again. You're seeing them throughout the world now, including in Iraq and in Lebanon and in Chile and other places, demanding that governments manage better, address corruption, and be able to manage the implications of serious existential crises. And climate change is certainly at the forefront of that.
We're talking with Shelley English. She's the executive director of the University of Dayton's Human Rights Center at the University of Dayton. Yes, Ken.
Shelley, I hear you talking about climate change as one of the factors, but also even before this became a big factor in Syria, wasn't there a big issue about the dictatorship, the Assad regime, Assad's father, and him as totally ruthless dictators, and they would kill their opponents. They had chemical and biological weapons against their own people, and they were pretty ruthless dictatorships. So that was kind of a populist reason that's more like the other Arab Spring countries, in addition to the climate change factor that pushed it further.
Well, and the other thing is, I mean, didn't the U.S. say that they would respond if we could show that there were these kinds of biological and chemical weapons.
That
was the red line that we never actually sort of we made the statement. We just didn't follow through on what we found out the result was. In fact, they were using biological and chemical weapons. I mean, that's part of the problem. We go to the UK and the US as somehow they're going to be our last resort and they're going to demand some kind of an appropriate response. And then the UK and the US abandoned Syria.
Well, I mean, the U.S. ended up eventually getting involved in Syria after the red line crisis because of the rise in ISIS. And, of course, Syria is one of many, as you both know, of very prolonged conflicts, many of which, you know, came out of the Arab Spring and also linked to 9/11 and that episode in American history. And the global war on terror. So the U.S. subsequently did get involved, and certainly the removal of the small presence of the U.S. It was a very strategic presence in October by Donald Trump. Meant that's sort of the period you can see a shift in what's happening and enabling this current crisis with Russia.
In terms of perspective, wasn't al-Qaeda in Syria one of the factions that was fighting with us against ISIS, right? Al-Qaeda in Syria, and there was another group, completely militant terrorist group that we wouldn't normally join with, was also fighting against ISIS, right?
But you know what?
Right.
Go on, Shelley. Go on, answer.
Yeah, I was just going to say that is you know, the perspective on many of the rebel opposition groups and what is used by the Assad regime in Russia is this terminology of terrorist organizations, and that they're attack on Idlib now is on terrorist organizations. Of course, the UN and others have been claiming that they're actually attacking civilians, that it's a strategic move on their part to explicitly target civilian sites, which are schools and hospitals and individual women and children and others who would not be terrorists in a part of the terrorist groups, and that they're not actually attacking the frontline fighters. The UN just came out with a report, as I'm sure you've seen in the news, and as I mentioned, claiming that Russia is committing war crimes in northern Syria. I think it is very, very complex, and that is why I think it is hard over the 9 years for many Americans to have kept understanding and thinking about what has happened in Syria. The complexity of the amount of groups involved and their allegiances and alliances, the internationalized nature of the conflict with Iran and Turkey, Russia, the European Union, the United States, all involved, certainly means that it isn't an easy conflict to solve. And it hasn't been solved, and that's demonstrated today. But I do want to go back. Of course, I think the authoritarian nature of the regime and of many Arab regimes at the time of the Arab Spring was, a main issue. And it is, of course, now this combination, I think, of both people demanding better what we call civil and political rights, so the kinds of issues that you were talking about around authoritarianism, freedom of speech and freedom of representation, as security, free media, with demanding also economic and social issues be addressed. So, response to very austerity policies in governments that mean that individuals do not have basic sort of economic security, the lack of, as I said, response to climate change, the lack of a response to social issues are as on top of people's minds today as these other civil and political rights. But certainly this has been an extremely complex crisis, and because there has not been a concerted effort to try and solve it amongst the key players, so Russia and the United States, Turkey, the European Union, really coming together and saying, how are we going to address this crisis? That has not been able to take place. And unfortunately, Because of the nature of the United Nations Security Council with veto powers in play, the United Nations has not ultimately been able to bring a peaceful solution.
Exactly. So I kind of asked this question, and I don't know, I know you can't give me the answer, Shelley. So if we change administrations in November of 2020, and we have a new administration coming in, what kind of guidance would you give to this new administration, given the fact that Donald Trump has just made everything even more fractious than it was before, especially when he removed the troops and the Syrian Kurds were just completely devastated by what he did? So if you had to give kind of like a four-point plan, or tell me what to sort of ask if I get Biden in front of me or whomever it is that ends up being the nominee, like, what do I need to ask vis-a-vis Syria? What do you recommend? And you made an interesting point that when you look at places like Lebanon and Jordan and Turkey, they're overwhelmed with refugees. We are now taking fewer refugees than we've ever taken in our history. And yet, if we want people to feel stable and we're asking Lebanon and Jordan, or they're, for whatever reason, accepting them, how do we assist them? Because we don't want to create even more sort of toxicity by creating the unrest that we're seeing in Syria begin to be the unrest of Lebanon, the unrest of Jordan, the unrest of Turkey, because it will end up coming back to harm all of us.
Yeah, and indeed, I mean, again, if you look in the newspapers today, and I'll get to your question, of course, the response of the European Union in supporting the Greek authorities in sort of violently pushing back the refugees into Turkey, that is not a response the international community, or at least under international norms, we would want to see.
Exactly.
We would want to see the European Union coming together, putting all their capacities to a sophisticated asylum-seeking machinery that can address the needs of refugees in an orderly fashion, in a safe fashion. We do not need refugees and migrants dying on their way to seeking a better life. That is not something we've wanted as the international community for a very long time. And this push against migrant and refugees that we see in Donald Trump is also a huge push out of the European Union. And of course, many look at the Brexit phenomenon and look to one of the root causes being also this fear of external migrants and being unable to control one's own borders. So you've seen a real collapse in the European Union, in my view, of true leadership on the, with the exception maybe of Germany and Angela Merkel, true leadership to address this crisis from the perspective of supporting refugees. So, of course, they have invested heavily. So in Lebanon, in Turkey, in Jordan, the international community provides a lot of funds for aid and for support for refugees. But that doesn't take care of the fact that these kinds of burdens on these countries can disrupt them. And
exactly.
Of course, Lebanon has a large social movement against the government and huge financial and fiscal crisis facing it. So I think to answer your question quickly, the immediate need is for a ceasefire. Many have argued that a safe zone is required. Turkey's now doing that on its own. While it is, of course, complex and difficult for Americans to see American military action again, and there's been a big demand of the population to withdraw the United States from these quote-unquote endless wars, certainly a no-fly zone and a ceasefire are the immediate needs. Working to come up with a humane refugee settlement program with the European Union and including the United States carrying some of that burden and other developed countries to work humanely on the refugee crisis is another dimension. And finally, I think the whatever can be done through the international mechanisms, supporting the international community, the United Nations. As you know, Donald Trump's administration has not been a very favorable administration to international mechanisms, to multilateral cooperation. We need to be working with our allies very constructively around this issue. And so I think there will be, if you in November there's a change in administration, there will be a very different approach taken to the Syria crisis. And I think there will also be a different approach taken overall to the Arab region, because it's time we revisit some of the assumptions around our support for certain
despots,
certain regimes in
regimes
on old premises about the way the world works. It's time for us to update completely our foreign policy, and I just hope. Taking into account the links, as we were discussing, I mean, among all these issues, that our foreign policy can get a major reboot in a new administration.
The worst humanitarian crisis of the 21st century. Five questions on Syria. Go to theconversation.com. Shelley Inglis, thank you so much for joining us. And I keep thinking about all the money that Mayor Bloomberg just spent on getting how many votes out of Samoa. And I keep thinking, God, what if he was able to use that for humanitarian purposes to deal with the issues of the refugees? Think of the lives he could have saved. Anyway, thank you so much for informing us. And I have a feeling we'll be calling you again.
Thanks for having me, Arnie. Have a good day.
You too. All right, everyone. We end with what?
End with So Much Trouble in the World. So Much Trouble in the World by Bob Marley.
Absolutely.
There is.
Just saw